From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, a House committee is voting on whether to admit Puerto Rico as a state. But Puerto Ricans have been here before.
This is Puerto Rico, Progress Island, USA.
Kind of reminds me of the Seinfeld episode where George Costanza tells the parents of his deceased fiance that he has a house in the Hamptons and they know it's not true.
This plebiscite is, at best, only a temporary solution. The United States is not legally bound by its result, and neither is Puerto Rico.
The only place where we can call ourselves sovereign is in sports. In sports, we get to be someone.
Right here, baby. Right here, Carlos. Carlitos.
Fight for the rebound. Here comes Arroyo.
We've been in a car with the United States headed to the Hamptons when we all know there's no house in the Hamptons.
It's all coming up after this.
Hi, I'm Alana Casanova Burgess, and I've got a quick note before we get to this week's On the Media. I'm the host of a podcast called La Brega, Stories of the Puerto Rican Experience. You've been hearing some of the episodes of La Brega on the Media feed, and that's because really, On the Media made the show possible. It's really an experiment in creating the kind of coverage, producing the kind of storytelling that puts the audience first, that tries to do justice to a place that a lot of the mainstream media gets wrong or just doesn't get at all. And by the way, we made this series in both English and Spanish, so we wouldn't leave anybody out. There's really nothing else like it. And I can tell you, La Brega wouldn't exist if the team here at On the Media and WNYC didn't say, hey, these are stories that really need to get reported out. It's got to get made. Let's do it. And the majority of our funding here at WNYC Studios comes from you, our listeners. So thank you. To support OTM and projects like La Brega, all you have to do is text the letters OTM to 70101. You'll get a text back with a link where you can make a quick donation or visit onthemedia.org and click donate. Thank you so much for your support. It's what makes our work possible. Gracias.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last month, many Puerto Ricans were incensed by spring breakers and other visitors who flouted local rules imposed to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Puerto Rico was one of the first U.S. jurisdictions to issue a mask mandate, and it maintained strict curfews. The pandemic wasn't politicized, and when it arrived amid earthquakes in the south and the protracted efforts to rebuild after Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rico's fragile healthcare system was still able to cope. Tourists are always welcome, but as one local told NBC News, people can't come here and act as if the virus doesn't exist. They have a sense of entitlement and apathy I don't understand. For the mainland, the island has long been a locus of both entitlement and apathy. But next week, politicians, some of them anyway, will be paying attention. On April 14th, Wednesday, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, the National Resources Committee, which oversees territorial affairs, will consider two competing bills. One would provide for the admission of Puerto Rico as a state. The other would provide for true self-determination. Either would be historic. Both are deeply opposed by the GOP. There's also a rich history of division within Puerto Rico over what its status should be, but most agree that the current situation, this disenfranchised limbo, isn't it. OTM producer Alana Casanova Burgess, also is host of the La Brega podcast, produced by WNYC and Futuro Studios. And in this episode, La Brega offers up some insight into that part of American history that the mainland mostly doesn't know and needs to understand. Here's Alana.
I've noticed that outside of Puerto Rico, many people seem uncomfortable calling the island a U.S. colony. In English, you'll hear the word territory or commonwealth, protectorate even. And that used to be the case in Puerto Rico, too. But not anymore.
Hay muchos en Puerto Rico, mucho, aún dentro de su partido, que dice que sí, que Puerto Rico es una colonia, por eso que se llama de descolonización.
Eso es, ser una colonia completamente.
Que Puerto Rico es una colonia de los Estados Unidos.
No sea una colonia.
People would twist themselves into pretzels to avoid the C word. And there's a reason for that.
Puerto Ricans were promised that they were not a colony.
This is Yarimar Bonilla. Yarimar is a political anthropologist. She has a column in the Puerto Rican newspaper El Nuevo Día, and she's also written for outlets like The Washington Post and The Nation. That promise that Yarimar mentioned about not being a colony, it's pretty much been broken. In 1952, Puerto Rico had adopted this new political status called the ELA, the Estado Libre Asociado, or Free Associated State, which doesn't really mean much. In English, we call it a commonwealth. And what does that mean? Is it like the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? No. Is it like the Commonwealth of Canada? Also no. Commonwealth doesn't really mean anything concrete, but it's the kind of word that made everyone feel better about the U.S. having a colony. The Estado Libre Asociado, the ELA, promised self-governance, but not independence. It was a kind of compromise created by the island's first elected governor, Luis Muñoz Marín, in order to massage the continued colonial interests of the U.S. and Puerto Rico and present a sovereign future to his residents. Marín came up with this label that sounded like decolonization.
He thought that, like, since it had all this language of decolonization, he thought that he could set legal precedents to kind of, if you build it, they will come. Like, if you build it, they will decolonize kind of idea. And then, meanwhile, the United States, they're like, well, we're going to pretend that we're decolonizing, but we're not really going to decolonize. So it's like both parts were kind of calling each other on their bluff. It kind of reminds me of this, like, Seinfeld episode that I love where, like, George Costanza meets up with the parents of his deceased fiance, and he tells them he has a house in the Hamptons, and they know it's not true.
It's a 2-hour drive. Once you get in that car, we are going all the way to the Hamptons.
And they all get into a car and start driving to the Hamptons. And they also all know that the others know that it's all a farce.
Almost there. Yeah, this is the end of Long Island. Where's your house? We go on foot from here. All right.
So I basically, like, we've been in a car with the United States headed to the Hamptons when we all know there's no house in the Hamptons, you know?
There's some indication that Luis Muñoz Marín and the U.S. Congress both knew there was no house in the Hamptons. In 1950, while testifying in a House committee hearing, he said, quote, "If the people of Puerto Rico should go crazy, Congress can always get around and legislate again." That's what he said in Washington, D.C. But in Puerto Rico, he claimed this new status would be a definitive end to, quote, "every trace of colonialism." Part of the promise of the ELA was that it was supposedly the best of both worlds. Self-governance with the protection of the U.S. military and the mobility of a U.S. passport. It was also imagined as a key to prosperity, having a link to the wealthy U.S. while also being able to manage our own affairs. But that was 70 years ago, and recently this idea has been dealt some severe blows. 15 years ago, a recession became a debt crisis, which is now an austerity crisis. Then, in 2016, during two Supreme Court hearings, the U.S. government itself pushed the argument that Puerto Rico wasn't really sovereign after all. The next nail in the coffin came in 2016. It was a law named, unironically, Ley Promesa, or Promise. That's the federal law that installed a fiscal control board to manage the island's finances and implement austerity policies in order to service the debt. These series of events created an awakening. In response to the Promesa law, protesters declared that the time of the promises was over. Se acabaron las promesas. The ELA had been a lie. Something between Puerto Rico and the U.S. had been broken.
After all these revelations, people started talking about the death of the ELA, the death of the Commonwealth. And I became really fascinated by that idea. Like, what does it mean for a political project to die?
In what some called a sign of mourning, black and white Puerto Rican flags started popping up instead of the red, white, and blue one. There were murals denouncing colonialism, too. And then came the deaths from Maria. Not metaphorical, not performative, but thousands of lives lost in the aftermath. And here is where maybe Puerto Rico could have used the benefits of the island's murky relationship with the U.S. to rebuild from the hurricane. Instead, President Trump threw his infamous paper towels and the White House slow-walked funds, leaving many residents without electricity for nearly a year. Some people are still living under tarps, 3 years later.
Who feels decolonized in Puerto Rico? Like, who's like, we're good? I want to start at the beginning. I want to think about what was the ELA promised to be and who believed in that promise. Who said we had a house in the Hamptons?
Yarimar decided to start right at home with her grandmother.
Ay, 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 ay. Come, te no llore.
That voice you hear is my 93-year-old grandmother, Maria Monserrate Fuentes Gerena, better known as Monsi. She loves to sing. In fact, it's hard to get her to stop singing.
Acércate más.
Like many Puerto Ricans, I grew up very close to my grandmother. She was always around, telling me to fix my hair, asking me if I was really going to go out dressed like that, and basically helping raise me along with my mother. During the pandemic, we spent lots of time joking around and filming funny videos for Instagram, where her handle is Bad Monsi. This is us with my mom singing Bad Bunny. No joke, my grandma really does love Bad Bunny.
Habla malo, pero actúa bien.
She thinks he has a potty mouth, but a good heart.
Ay, me encanta Bad Bunny. A mí me encanta él.
The pandemic has also given me a chance to discover her surprising brushes with history.
Yo fui a un cumpleaños de Muñoz Marín, yo te lo dije.
It turns out she had gone to a birthday party for none other than Gobernador Luis Muñoz Marín. She was invited by a suitor who coyly asked if she liked to join him at a birthday function. When he explained who the party was for, she lost it.
Yo qué?
I asked her what she wore to this special occasion, and unsurprisingly, she dressed in red, the color of Muñoz's party. She wore a bright red pantsuit and a pava, the straw hat traditionally worn by Puerto Rican peasants. This was her homage to the color and symbol of Muñoz's party, the Populares. She's bummed that there weren't cell phones back then so she could have a picture, not just of her slamming outfit, but of this historic encounter. What she remembers most fondly about those times is the conviction and commitment of the political leaders.
Ramos Antonini.
She fondly remembers Ernesto Ramos Antonini, the well-known black socialist lawyer who was one of the founders of the party. But her favorite, of course, was Luis Muñoz Marín. Just looking at him, she says, inspired confidence. She loves to talk about how he would go to the chozas of the jíbaros, homes with dirt floors and few belongings, and have coffee with the residents in the little cups they fashioned out of hollowed-out coconuts. He swore the coconut cups made the coffee taste even better. Every time she tells the story, something about that small gesture of grace really gets to her. She's convinced that he really did love Puerto Rico and just wanted the best for it.
Que él sentía, amaba Puerto Rico. Él lo amaba, él lo amaba.
This kind of uncritical nostalgia is a common staple among Puerto Rican abuelitas. But actually, Luis Muñoz Marín did a lot to erase rural life through his emphasis on industrial development. But for my grandmother, it was all about eradicating the poverty that she grew up with. Bread, land, and liberty. That was the promise. And my grandmother believed in it because she saw it with her own eyes. Lands were being massively redistributed. Even her uncle got a parcel. During this time, industry was also arriving. Homes and schools were being built.
Y siguió mejorando, y siguió mejorando.
For my grandmother, everything was getting better and better. The ELA really did seem like the best we could hope for, the best of all possible worlds.
The people of Puerto Rico felt, hey, el ELA, lo mejor de los dos mundos.
This is Deepak Lambanieves. He's a development planner at the Center for a New Economy and a good friend. Deepak argues that the ELA was never really about decolonizing Puerto Rico. It was about using Puerto Rico as an economic experiment, as a counterpoint to communism during the Cold War.
Apartment complexes, bilingual schools, modern hospitals, luxury hotels. Progress can be seen everywhere. This is Puerto Rico, Progress Island, USA.
To the outside, the ELA was sold as an economic success story. But all that economic growth was built on unsustainable compromises. From the beginning, there was an over-reliance on tax incentives, which Washington could enact and take away as it pleased. Once the tax incentives were taken away, companies started fleeing Puerto Rico, and the government took on massive debt to stay afloat. By 2016, it became clear that Puerto Rico was descending into what economists literally call a death spiral. Everyone began putting pressure on Washington to pass some kind of debt relief. Among those making the rounds on Capitol Hill was Deepak. He thought,
hey, there's another way of addressing the Puerto Rican dilemma with the economic situation and also the debt issue.
He was initially confident about the impact he could have. He assumed he would be taken seriously. After all, he's a smart guy who works at a fancy think tank where they had developed a solid, cost-effective plan. But Washington politicians had no time for him. Deepak says they made him feel like he was begging for a handout, or worse, praying for mercy. He returned from D.C. convinced that Puerto Rico was quite simply a colony, and that the island just doesn't matter to the United States. If you read a news story about Puerto Rico's debt crisis, you will most likely see it accompanied by a picture of desolate Paseo de Diego. This pedestrian mall used to be a bustling commercial district. Visitors from surrounding parts of the Caribbean would come and load up on goods to sell back home. My mom was a master seamstress. Every year we would do our back-to-school shopping, happily combing through the big bolts of fabric at stores like La Riviera, where we would purchase fabric for a whole semester's worth of new handmade dresses. Now, that's a long-lost memory. Most of those stores are shuttered, and the few that remain are struggling to survive. Alana and I were recently in Río Piedras at a time when it felt much more active. There was a caravana, a political rally where people get in their cars and drive around following a candidate during election season. We were asking folks there if the ELA had died. And one guy was quick to answer.
El ELA es un engaño. No murió. Él ni siquiera nunca nació.
It never died, he said, because it was never born. He was there supporting a new movement in Puerto Rico that wants to stop talking about status and focus on other fundamental issues like government corruption, gender violence, and the need to audit the debt. The caravana was for the campaign of a young politician named Manuel Natal. He narrowly lost the race to be San Juan's mayor, but even this near victory was astonishing, given that Natal is from a brand new political party.
So how would you define the ELA?
It was el maquillaje de la colonia. It was a way of putting a little bit of makeup on our colonial relationship with the United States.
A little lipstick on the pig.
Yeah, yeah. The pig is the colony, not the people of Puerto Rico.
Good.
Natal actually used to really believe in the Ela. He comes from a family of populares and was once a rising star in the party. But a few years ago, he made a radical decision and became an independent, citing corruption among his colleagues. Then, along with other progressive leaders, he helped found a new political party called Movimiento Victoria Ciudadana. Its members have different visions. Many are pro-independence, but some are pro-statehood. And others, like Natal, are soberanistas, meaning they want more local sovereignty while still retaining their ties to the U.S. But they all agree on one thing. Decolonization is necessary, and we need a new process for deciding which status we want. For decades, the political parties in Puerto Rico have been organized around status options. And every couple of years, we undergo these performative votes that are described as plebiscites or referendums. Back in the late 60s, when NBC was reporting on the first plebiscite vote, they called out right away the irony of this spectacle.
Most Puerto Ricans, even those who favor a commonwealth, agree on one thing. This plebiscite is, at best, only a temporary solution. The United States is not legally bound by its results, and neither is Puerto Rico.
At best, these are little more than opinion polls. In the most recent one last November, the statehood option won by a slim margin, receiving 52% of the votes cast. But these plebiscites are non-binding. They're not tied to any legislation and have no support in Washington. They're basically another bluff. It's like, once again, we're getting in a car heading for the Hamptons.
So what are our other alternatives?
Natal's party proposes what they call a constitutional assembly, in which representatives of each political option could negotiate directly with Washington the terms of each status choice. And what would this do? Ideally, it would bring concrete answers to enduring questions, like, would we have dual citizenship if we were independent? Would we have access to federal programs like Pell Grants as an associated republic? And maybe the most delicate question, but also the most important one. Would any of these options be tied to reparations for over 120 years of colonial rule? I started the pandemic posting videos of my grandmother on social media, joking that she was la influencer. But by the time the political campaigns were in full swing, she had become a bona fide social media sensation.
Dime, hija, ¿por quién vas a votar? Pues yo quiero un cambio, pero un cambio radical.
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 I posted a video of her in a rocking chair where I asked her how she was going to vote this time around. She surprised us all by saying that she supported the pro-independence candidate Juan Dalmau. The conventional wisdom was that only young voters were supporting the alternative candidates like Natal and Dalmau, and that older voters were afraid of change. Her video went viral. Dalmau even used it for one of his TV spots. And then the morning shows came calling.
Como toda una influencer, como Bad Bunny ha conquistado las redes sociales por sus videos.
She then wrote and sang a political song that also took off.
Ni azul es ni colorado.
Ajá.
Ni azul es ni colorado. Yo quiero la patria nueva que nos propone Dalmau.
Ahí está.
And the weekend before the election, Dalmau himself actually came to visit her and brought her flowers, which put her over the moon.
No lo puedo creer.
After a lifetime of voting for the populares and of supporting the ELA, her public support of an independentista was surprising. But it doesn't mean that she wants independence itself.
No, no independencia por ahora.
She told me she voted for Dalmau simply because she thought he would make a good governor. As far as the status, she felt like that could be dealt with later.
Entonces después se podía bregar con lo otro, sabe, poco a poco.
Like a good popular, she thinks we should just kick the status can down the road. But you know who is really kicking that can down the road really hard all the time? The U.S. Congress. They refuse to commit to anything, or to even speak clearly about why it insists on keeping Puerto Rico as an ambiguous transition land. So where does that leave us? Honestly, I don't know. But I'm skeptical of all the options currently on the table. For example, when I consider independence, I get excited about the possibility of being our own country. But then I look around at our neighbors in the Caribbean and see that many have the same challenges as Puerto Rico. Indebted economies, austerity regimes, huge diasporas, the challenges of disaster recovery, and battles over corruption. Independence is clearly not a silver bullet. It doesn't guarantee sovereignty. Instead of battling the Fiscal Control Board, we might end up battling the World Bank or the IMF. But when I consider statehood, I think of Hawaii and how the native population there was shut out of much of the prosperity and development that statehood supposedly ushered in. Or I look at the movement for Black lives in the U.S. and the discrimination suffered by people of color in the States. And it makes me wonder if anything other than second-class citizenship will ever be available to us. So I end up back where we've been for all these years, at an impasse. Yet, something feels different about the current moment. The signs of change might be subtle, but they're there. In the ubiquity of the black and white protest flags, in the dark lyrics of a Bad Bunny song, and in the transformations at the ballot box as thousands move towards alternative candidates. So perhaps, if the death of the ELA and the end of the promises means anything, it's the realization that the world we deserve is not something that can be promised, conceded, or guaranteed, but it's also not something that we can keep waiting for.
Coming up, that one time Puerto Rico absolutely owned the U.S. in basketball.
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As we learned before the break, there are movements for and against independence in Puerto Rico. But in the meantime, the island stays in limbo with representatives in the United States Congress, but no say in who becomes president and many other such indignities. However, there is at least one international body that considers the island its own sovereign nation. And that is the International Olympic Committee, which has exclusive authority to determine which states count as countries for the purposes of Olympic law. And the IOC regards Puerto Rico as a country. And that's how the stage came to be set for one of the most epic showdowns in the island's sporting history. Here's Alana.
Without a doubt, there is a deep connection between being Puerto Rican and rooting for our sports teams. And yes, people all over the world love sports and are proud of their athletes. But in Puerto Rico, the stakes are just higher. Because Puerto Rico, despite being a U.S. colony, competes in international sporting events like the Olympics on its own, under its own flag, as if we were an independent country. Journalist Noel Algarin, who has covered sports in Puerto Rico for many years, put it this way.
The only place where we can call ourselves sovereign is in sports. In sports, we get to be someone. And then we get chances in a more symbolic way to face the country that owns you in some way.
We're going to tell a story about one of those chances, a time when Puerto Rico faced off against the United States in basketball on the sporting world's largest stage. Journalist Julio Ricardo Varela was born in Puerto Rico and grew up there. But when he was in first grade, he moved with his mom to the Bronx and would go back and forth to the island over the years. But he never had any doubt as to who his team was. It was always Puerto Rico.
Flor Meléndez was a coach of the team.
Bueno, mi nombre es Flor Meléndez.
And he was a legend in Puerto Rico. In a documentary about the 1979 games, you can see him screaming at players and gesturing wildly. He's looking really sharp with this thick black mustache and fro. Flor went on to become one of the national team's all-time most decorated coaches. And his story kind of runs parallel to the story of Puerto Rican basketball. So Flor grew up in a big family.
11 hermanos.
The oldest of 11 siblings. They lived in public housing.
Caserío público.
We're talking 1960. Flor started playing basketball at his local YMCA. Then as a teenager, he played in the Puerto Rican League. And pretty early on, Flor figured he had a talent for coaching. He described his coaching style as
fuerte,
tough.
Yo soy una persona que me gusta la disciplina.
Discipline heavy. And Flor got into coaching right around this kind of magic moment for Puerto Rican basketball. Coaches like Flor started visiting New York City and scouting the courts where New Yorkers were playing street ball. And they started convincing these players to leave their lives behind to come play professionally in Puerto Rico. Here are these amazing Afro-Puerto Ricans who learned the craft in the mecca of the sport and brought it back. It was a different kind of basketball than people were used to in Puerto Rico. It was a faster rhythm of play with big dunks. And it was fun. Like, that type of basketball is fun. These were the boom years for Puerto Rican basketball. And as the team kept winning and becoming better, basketball in Puerto Rico became the sport. Fans filled the stadiums. By the 90s, many from that generation of great New Yorican players had retired, but they had inspired a new wave of Puerto Rican-born players. And those players, they took the team to even greater heights.
Ganando Puerto Rico.
Gar undécimos Juegos Panamericanos.
Gold in the 1991 Pan American Games. Gold in the 1993 Central American Games. And maybe the biggest accomplishment of all, fourth place in the 1990 World Championships. Puerto Rico, the fourth best team in the world. That's pretty good. With Puerto Rico having made a name for itself on the international stage, Flor Meléndez got opportunities to coach in Argentina and Panama, but it was always clear to him that coaching the Puerto Rican national team, that was a different kind of responsibility.
Yo tengo un dicho que
he has this saying.
La bola de baloncesto es el alma. Nosotros no tenemos ejército.
He thinks about it like this. Puerto Rico doesn't have an army, so we, the national basketball team, we are the ones that have to represent the country. He says that the basketball is a weapon and the basketball jersey is actually a soldier's uniform. It's like you respect it like you respect a flag. He told me he had this ritual he would do with the national team that at the season's first practice where they would put on their national team jerseys for the first time.
Pues yo le entregaba a ellos.
He'd go down the line and hand out little Puerto Rican flag pins to all the players. He says the players would get so emotional about it. And whenever they'd face the United States in international play, those games had a special kind of weight. It was the chance for his soldiers to go to war. The war we haven't been able to have to win our independence, he says. Puerto Rico was generally pretty outgunned in this war. The U.S., after all, was and is the global superpower of basketball, especially after the 1992 Barcelona Olympics. What happened was a few years before, the International Basketball Federation made a change to their rules to allow NBA players in international competitions. And that change was huge.
This summer, the U.S. Olympic basketball team will make history. The dream team of Jordan, Bird, Ewing, Robinson, Pippen, Drexler, Mullins, Barkley, and Magic.
That first dream team that went to Barcelona in 1992 was legendary.
This collection of superstars has been unselfishly magnificent.
It wasn't just a sports team. It was a cultural phenomenon.
You've got yourself the gold medal meal.
What you want is what you get.
At McDonald's today!
Gold medal? It's in the bag.
And they kicked everybody's ass. It wasn't even close. It wasn't even fun to watch. They were that good.
And there it is. And the Dream Team win gold.
And from then on, the players changed. But the Dream Team was here to stay. The U.S. won gold again in 1996 at the Atlanta Olympics.
The United States has won the gold.
In 2000 at the Sydney Olympics, same story.
And it's all smiles now from Dream Team 4.
And then you get to the 2004 Olympics in Athens, and the U.S. team was an institution at that point. And the first game they were going to play that Olympics was with Puerto Rico. The 2004 team was stacked. Allen Iverson, AI, Dwayne Wade, D-Wade, Tim Duncan, one of my favorite players of all time. I mean, the team even had LeBron James in his early days. LeBron James. These guys were invincible in the Olympics. I mean that literally. Since NBA players were allowed to play, they had never lost an Olympic game. They were the Death Star. And if the U.S. team was the Death Star, the Puerto Rico team was definitely the ragtag rebel alliance. The players were mostly local stars from the Baloncesto Superior Nacional, the league in Puerto Rico. You had Jose Ortiz, also known as Piculín.
Oh, that's the leader, the rock, the legend.
That's Julio Cesar Torres. He's the filmmaker behind a great Puerto Rican basketball documentary called New Eurican Basket. You had Eddie Casiano.
Eddie, man, Eddie was the firecracker. He would go toe-to-toe with you. And if he had to fight, he would fight.
McGrady and Casiano going nose-to-nose.
Rolando Jorutiner.
He was all about the craft, very disciplined, and a great defender.
And a lot of other really talented guys. Larry Ayuso, Bobby Joe Hatton. And then there was Carlos Arroyo.
Carlos Arroyo was the young gun.
Arroyo por el cristal, su primer canasto de la noche.
Anxious to prove himself with a lot of talent.
As Arroyo knocks down that jumper.
Carlos was in the NBA. He was a starting point guard with the Utah Jazz that season and was on a path to becoming a legend.
Arroyo to the angle right, gets behind tag, shaking and baking, and they double him momentarily. Now he goes right to the hoop, reverse to the right side, bank it up and in, count it, he's fouled.
At 6'2", he was a lot shorter than most other NBA guys, but Carlos was fast, and he played with energy, and he played with heart, and we all loved him. So a few weeks before the Olympics, the Puerto Rican team goes to Florida for a week of practice and a series of warm-up games against the U.S. team. This is strangely standard practice leading up to these big international competitions. And at these games, they're playing man-to-man defense, which is what it sounds like. Each player follows a player on the other team and sticks to them. And Puerto Rico, because of their size or lack of it, you know, the Americans are bigger, they were faster. They wanted to play zone defense where you literally stay in a zone and you defend a set area of the court. During one of those games, the American coach went up to the Puerto Rican coaches and asked for a favor.
Que por favor, que no le jugáramos.
He said, can you please not play zone during this game? And it was one of those like Flor Melendez moments to be like, insert mysterious discovery music. Interesting. They don't want to play against a zone.
Y después nosotros, pues, nos quedamos callados.
He says they kept quiet and pulled a classic jíbaro move. He says whenever city people visit the mountains, they think the jíbaros, the country people, are simpletons. But secretly, they always have something
up their sleeve.
Coming up, the Puerto Rican national basketball team goes to the Olympics.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We pick up the story in the summer of 2004. The Puerto Rican national basketball team has arrived in Athens to compete in the Olympics. Journalist Julio Varela takes it from here.
On the morning of the game in Athens, the Puerto Rican team is expecting the worst. Rolando Orutined was in his dorm room in the Olympic Village when one of the coaches on the staff, Julio Toro, barged in the room.
Early in the morning, Julio comes in. He's like, hey, you guys, what's going on, Julio? It's too early, man. So I want you guys to know that we're going to do something different today. I said, what are you talking about? He's like, well, you have to wait and see.
A few hours later, the players are gathered in the locker room and the coaches bust out their plan. They thought maybe they had found the weakness in the Death Star. They're going to do a variation on the zone defense that the Americans didn't want to play against back in Florida. For all you basketball nerds out there, a variation known as a triangle and two defense, with the goal of forcing the U.S. team to take outside shots.
So, Lou, we looked at each other like, hey, you know, never done it. We lose by 30 every time, so might as well try it.
The game was set to start at 8 p.m. Athens time, 1 p.m. in Puerto Rico. To jog my memory for this story, I recently rewatched the game.
I'm excited. This is the first time I've put this on since 2004.
You can see in the broadcast that the arena in Athens was pretty full. Everybody wanted to see the debut of the U.S. team. The whistle blows. The start of the game, it was pretty tight back and forth.
United States leading early by two.
Puerto Rico didn't really start off strong. They just played enough to keep it close.
An impressive start for Puerto Rico.
I was like, okay, all right. How long is this going to last? This will be entertaining until the U.S. scores like 80 points in a row, and then we're down by 60.
And there's the buzzer ending the first quarter.
But for me, things really kicked off in the second quarter when Carlos Arroyo found Piculín with a super cool pass. Here it comes. Look at this pass. Hello.
Carlos Arroyo. Oh, what a ball fake.
And then it begins. Something just clicks. And Puerto Rico has this sequence of amazing plays.
Excellent ball handling from Carlos Arroyo. Bodies flying all over the place. Arroyo with the steal.
Floor watch Puerto Rico nails shot after shot. He says he noticed the U.S. players in a bad mood, frustrated, and it was probably because the Puerto Rican strategy seemed to be working. Here's Rolando Orutined.
You know, we were pretty physical and we were really giving it to them, you know, and it's something that they were not used to it. And it was our turn to talk trash.
Go ahead and shoot it. You don't want to shoot it, right? Go ahead, shoot it. Let me see it. Let me see your shot, right?
As the second quarter ticked down, Puerto Rico's lead just kept growing.
It's hard to believe I'm saying this, but the United States trails by 20. And there's the buzzer ending the first half. A disastrous first half for the United States.
At halftime, the score was 49-27. 22-point lead for Puerto Rico. And you could see it on the faces of the American coaches. They looked so dejected. Meanwhile, at 1 p.m. in Puerto Rico, Ira Martinez, then a sports editor at El Nuevo Día, was getting ready to turn on the game when his wife asked him to go to the mall with her to pick something up. Reluctantly, Iram goes to the mall and finds a store window with the televisions turned to the game. About 100 people were crowded around doing the same thing. And to Iram's surprise, Puerto Rico's doing pretty well in the first minutes. But he thinks, who cares? They're just going to come back and slam us. So he heads back home in the car when he gets a call from his daughter. Are you watching the game? She asks. Iram's like, no, why bother? And she says, we're winning. Soon Iram is getting frantic calls from the newspaper. Where are you? Get over here. We're beating the U.S. and we're beating them good.
Y yo, no, no puede ser.
Even the Puerto Rican players in the locker room at halftime were surprised at the score. Here's Rolando.
First of all, my first thought was, wow, I have more pressure now than I did at the beginning of the game. Because it's a brand new game, 20 brand new minutes. And you know they're going to come back stronger.
You thought the Americans were going to make a run eventually and come back and beat us. They had to. The third quarter is also really back and forth. The U.S. makes points.
Good drive to the basket. Pretty move from Allen Iverson.
But Puerto Rico maintains its lead.
Arroyo inside and the lead back up to 21.
The quarter closes 65-48. Puerto Rico is still leading by 17 points. And then the fourth quarter starts. And that's when things get scary. It starts with about 9 minutes left on the clock. Puerto Rico's up by 15. And LeBron James.
James wide open and hits the three. LeBron James from downtown, and it's a 12-point game.
It was the first three for the United States in a long time. And then they just keep making baskets.
Lamar Odom cuts the lead to 12. Iverson for three. Boy, that's a huge bucket.
On the court, Rolando watched as Puerto Rico's hard-fought lead disappeared. From 22 at halftime to just 8 points.
I would look up at the clock. I'm like, to me, it's like, hurry up and, you know, finish, right? I just want to end this game.
Suddenly, it looked like the U.S. could turn the tide in the final minutes. But then... Right here, baby. Right here, Carlos. Carlitos.
Fight for the rebound. Here comes Arroyo.
Carlitos!
Arroyo draws the foul and one.
That was awesome. Up by 11. Puerto Rico answers the charge. Suddenly, only 1 minute remains. Puerto Rico is back to leading by 20, and it's clear. The U.S. has run out of time to catch up. With victory near, the coach takes Carlos Arroyo out of the game.
Carlos Arroyo, the game of his life, 24 points as he comes out.
As he walks off the court, cocky as all hell, he looks at the stands and grabs his jersey and pulls forward the part where it says Puerto Rico, as if to show everybody watching the name of the place he's from.
Oh, that was awesome when he did that.
In part, it was a gesture of defiance to a U.S. player who had fouled him a few moments ago. But to many in the audience watching, the message was way bigger than that.
Fue como decirle a los tipos.
Flort says that it was like Carlos was telling the Americans,
nosotros somos los poderosos, ¿viste? O sea,
look, we're the powerful ones. In the newsroom in San Juan, people started hugging each other. Tears were falling. The final score, 92-73.
It's finally happened. The United States loses in Olympic play with NBA players. They showed some signs in the second.
Back at the offices of El Nuevo Día, everyone was buzzing to get the paper ready for the morning. They had already decided on the cover when Iram saw a photo come in that instantly caught his eye. It's of Carlos Arroyo showing off his Puerto Rico jersey. It was this quick moment on the court. If you blinked, you could have missed it. And Iram says,
esta es la foto.
This is the photo. The layout designer was like, no way, we already have the cover. But Iram's like, this is the photo. This is the photo we're going to be talking about 50, 100 years from now. This needs to be the cover.
Cuando hablemos de ese juego, esta es la foto que siempre va a tener la gente en la mente.
All night long, the island celebrates the win. The next morning, the team wakes up and heads mostly together to the cafeteria for breakfast. And as they walk through the Olympic Village,
eran todas las delegaciones.
All the delegations of athletes from around the world were there. And as they walked into the cafeteria, Flor says, you'd think it was a Puerto Rican party.
Todos los países
Everybody from the Germans to the Iraqis, all of them stood up, stopped eating, and clapped for Puerto Rico.
Imagínate, eso uno no se lo imagina nunca que eso pueda pasar.
He says it's something one never imagined could happen. They were getting a standing ovation from the world. And it's just a fleeting moment. That's the thing that is just so bittersweet about it. It's 24 hours of joy, and then that's it. The team doesn't perform nearly as well for the rest of the tournament. They were eliminated in the quarterfinals in a game against Italy. But when Puerto Ricans remember Athens, they don't remember losing to Italy. They remember beating the United States. Rolando Urrutined says people on the island still come up to him and thank him.
It was very emotional for the island. It's the day that we beat USA. It's like David beat Goliath.
It hasn't been 50 or 100 years yet, but the image of Carlos Arroyo grabbing the jersey has become an enduring symbol of Puerto Rican power and pride. Everybody knows that image. It was even painted as a mural in Viejo San Juan. I think it means more than ever now. To me, 2004 was before the hard times hit Puerto Rico. The debt, hurricanes, people leaving, political failures. This creeping feeling of failure, of no hope, because everywhere around you, you know, you're not winning. So I think there's something special about looking back at what happened in Athens. That moment when the game is over and Puerto Rico is on top, it tells people that yes, you can win. So that's why you gotta hold up that jersey and show it off a little bit.
That's it for this week's show, but you can and should go to the La Brega podcast feed to listen to the other episodes in the series. Every episode is available in English and Spanish.
The stories in this episode of On the Media were produced by Alana Casanova Burgess, who's actually leaving the OTM team this week to go on to new adventures. She's been a prime mover of some of our best work, a passionate voice, and a leader. Alana, you are a force who helped propel us forward, and we will eagerly, instantly, tune into whatever you do next. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Leadership support for La Brega is provided by the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, with additional support provided by Amy Liss. A-O-O.